thing I'd be curious about is if you began your medical education in the early 1930s, what was it like for two young men to get into medical school?
At that time, it was quite difficult for the average student, or any student, as a matter of fact, to get into American medical schools. In fact, there was a quota system. And in other words, the University of Pittsburgh, for example, took about 10% of their students were Jewish. And a freshman class, for example, which normally had about 100 students, they would only take about 10.
And did you personally find this a hindrance?
Well, I found it no hindrance because my grades were rather good as an undergraduate at the University of Pittsburgh. And the reason I went abroad is because I did not know that I was going to medical school, and I didn't take certain subjects that are required, such as physics. I didn't take physics or chemistry. I took chemistry as a postgraduate, but I did not take physics. However, the University of London would accept me without the physics, so I was able to be admitted without any problem.
Did they have quotas as well?
No, there were no quotas. In Britain, not only no quotas, but they never asked my religion.
Well, that was not on your application?
That was not on the application.
What is the status today of American Jewish students who can't go to medical school? Is that still put it on the application?
I don't think that there is the space which asks for religion. And there is no problem now regarding Jewish students who are applying to medical school. As a matter of fact, in some New York schools, there may be 75% of the students are Jewish.
I find it surprising a lot that naive to think that our country had a quota and a stipulation on application and the European countries do not.
Well, very peculiar. For example, in England, I once attempted to rent a car. And on the application, which is given to everybody who wants to rent a car, it said, we will not accept you as one of our clients if you are, to rent a car, that is, if you are an actor or an actress, and they had other professions, and also if you are Jewish. And I wondered how the English government would allow that, or that the Jewish organization would permit that. Now, this was, of course, in 1930-31. Now, whether that is, I'm sure it has changed now. But you could rent a car, but you'd go to medical school.
I was just
going to
say, you could be there, you could doctor them, but not drive their automobiles.
Yeah.
Apparently, they thought, excuse me, good doctors and bad drivers.
I looked at that thing. Of course, I didn't say anything because I was driving, rented the car to make a trip, and I was with a non-Jewish fellow. And although we both drove the car, and I had never mentioned anything about it. I didn't want to stir up anything. But I thought that the Jewish organizations involved in such things should know about it.
In your long career, have you run into anti-Semitism in other areas?
No, I found no problem because I applied to the Paslin Hospital, and there was no problem. I also applied to the staff of the Montefiore, and fortunately there was no problem there. And I applied to the Elizabeth Steele McGee Hospital, and there was no problem there. As a matter of fact, it was rather interesting that when I was teaching at the university, that a greater percentage of the residents were Jewish. So I had no problem as far as my practice or my affiliation with the various organizations involved in medicine.
You had made the comment earlier on the tape that in your office, not all the doctors, not all your associates are Jewish.
Yes.
And I believe you can paraphrase it. I'm glad this was so, to show the hospitals that you were.
Well, we wanted to show that we're not prejudiced. Yes.
But it wasn't because of any particular pressure?
Oh, no. There was no pressure at all. This was our own decision. We didn't particularly select the non-Jewish man because he's non-Jewish. It so happened we selected him because he had been a good resident, that he had been, he had a lot of compassion, and we thought that he would make a good associate. We had refused some Jewish doctors who wanted to come with us, but it was not because they were Jewish, but it was because we thought, well, this man would be the better one for our particular work.
Your contribution in the field has been enormous, and has been documented in the community. Have you had time? Because I realize your life has been very busy. Has anything interested you? Have you had time to work on anything that you would like to tell us about?
As far as the community is concerned, well, unfortunately, my wife was very active in the community. I mean, she was president.
Fortunately or unfortunately?
No, I said unfortunately. So I felt, well, I am delegating all my duties to the community to Marcella. But I was chairman, for example, on several occasions of the United Jewish Federation and the medical division, and I was head of the medical division for the UJF on two occasions, I believe. And I belonged to the usual organizations, such as Brotherhood and so forth, although I did not participate. I mean, I have belonged, for example, and I should be ashamed of this, I belonged to Brotherhood of Temple for maybe 40 years. And I've never been to a meeting.
Well, I don't have anything to be ashamed of.
Well, I paid my dues, and that was the extent of it.
Well, the question wasn't meant to suggest that you should have, but rather, has there been something that fascinated you or interested you?
Not in the community. Oh, except, I was thinking of Jewish community, but I was very active in Planned Parenthood.
All right.
In fact, I was head of their infertility division. And I worked as a volunteer every Wednesday for, I would say 10, 12 years at the Planned Parenthood Clinic, doing only infertility. I didn't do the rest of the type of medical procedures that they do.
Did that involve counseling?
No, it didn't involve counseling. They had counselors who did that. I mean, they had social workers and psychiatrists. I did the actual sterility work, such as checking the patient's tubes, checking the husband's sperm count, checking doing the various procedures involved in an infertility study. So I did that on a volunteer basis until I got to the point where I was much too busy to do that, and they had gotten through me a resident at the McGee who was able to do all that.
Apparently, your field is catching up with you, who were way ahead on your research.
Yes, I saw that article. Now, you will find that infertility is now very popular with the lay people. All magazines have articles on infertility. Also, I don't know whether I stated this the last time, but since I left my office, retired, there have become innumerable men who are now doing infertility work in Pittsburgh. And that has happened all over the country. We had a very close type of group Now they're in the South. This has all developed in the last 25 years. Yet it is gratifying because it used to be that when there were calls for lectures or meetings regarding artificial insemination, it was invariably, let us say, 90% of the time I was called, would I attend this meeting and give my view on artificial insemination. Now there are innumerable men who are doing that, many, many doctors who are interested in these facilities who are being called.
Well,
I was one of the first that had maybe several hundred pregnancies, many pregnancies, more than a couple hundred per year. And it was embarrassing sometimes at an infertility meeting when people would ask various doctors, how many patients have you had who are artificially inseminated? And they would mention they've had so many. And I would have twice that amount in 1 week that they had for the whole year. And it got to the point where I didn't, in order to not appear as though I'm overstating the amount of patients that I had, I cut the number down so that I wouldn't be looked upon as a real freak doing all that artificial insemination.
How has Pittsburgh socially, culturally, physically changed for you over the years? Do you see it? People born here?
Well, socially, I suppose the same changes have occurred to me that have occurred to you or to Janet, that I don't know whether you're referring to the Jewish or the general.
Well, both. But it's your perception for me.
Well, I haven't noticed anything unusual socially. Even though my parents were early immigrants, that is, even before 1900, socially, I would say that both Marcel and I have become accepted in the Jewish community. First, because I was a successful physician. Secondly, because Marcella was interested in community interests, both Jewish and Gentile, for example. She was on the board of the United Way, which is important socially. She was asked to be president of Planned Parenthood on several occasions, but she refused because she felt, well, her husband was very, very active, and she didn't want to feel as though it was a family sort of thing. I'm bringing out these two things that she was interested in that were not Jewish-oriented. Also, she was very active in the University of Pittsburgh and their nationality rules. She was in charge of those rooms for quite a while. There are other non-Jewish interests that Marcella was involved in the community. And as I said, that I let her handle most of that. Socially, we belong to the Concordia Club for many, many years. We've gone to Westmoreland Country Club for 30 or some, 40 some odd years. So we had all the quotation marks social advantages that any young couple, Jewish couple, could have.
Do you see the changing patterns in Jewish life in Pittsburgh? Do you see more intermingling and more integration of Jewish life with
I feel that there is a lot of accommodation of Jewish and Gentile groups that we're not just Years ago, most Jews lived in the same ghetto area, even though it may have been Squirrel Hill or goodness knows what. We did not dare move to certain areas, such as Fox Chapel, because we'd be uncomfortable and so forth and so on. But I think that's all that's disappeared. That is, people move to any area that they want to. In fact, most of the changes of young people involve schooling. Where is the best school for my child? More than, will I be alone in this community because there are no other Jews? I think that has happened everywhere. And in fact, in the schools, for example, the University of Pittsburgh Medical School, law school, and so forth, there has been a great accommodation with Jews and Gentiles. To give you another example, my son, who is a lawyer, belongs to the Duquesne Club. Now, I assure you that when I was his age, that would have been almost impossible. But he is quite comfortable. He is with a Gentile, so-called Gentile law firm, where there are 150 lawyers. And he is, if I may say so, regarded as one of the leading lawyer in the firm. When he went in there were only 16 lawyers, no Jews. Now there are 150, counting 30 in Washington, D.C. So, I mean, there has been a change.
There has been.
And also in the organizations that I belong to, there were, for example, the American Society for Study of Infertility has always had quite a large Jewish complex of doctors. And the reason for that, I don't know, but it seems that doctors, Jewish doctors, were interested in infertility for some reason or other. And we had a great amount of Jewish doctors in that field. In fact, many of the doctors were officers in the Jewish doctors were officers in the organization. Also, take the McGee Hospital residents. There was a time when there were very few Jewish residents at the McGee.
Well, obviously, you made it to the quotas.
Well, there weren't so many quotas.
Medical school quotas, you didn't have.
Yes,
many.
We didn't have that amount, too many doctors available for that specialty. Also, it was rather interesting that I was also a resident at Chicagoland Hospital. It was rare for Chicago Lying In to have a Jewish doctor. It's rather interesting that even the head of the hospital, the founder of the hospital, the father of Chicago Lying In was Dr. DeLee, Joseph B. DeLee. His nephew could not become a resident at the hospital. And according to some, the reason he couldn't become the founder's nephew, mind you, is because he was Jewish. Oh, the founder was Jewish, and of course his nephew.
Why then the restriction?
We don't. I mean, why?
This was in the
30s. This was in the 30s. Now things have changed so much that today, in recent years, the head of Chicago Lion Hospital were such men as Dr. M. Edward Davis, who is Jewish, and the president, the man who is head of the University of Chicago School of Medicine Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology, and head of the Chicago Lion Hospital, is Jewish. And by the way, it'd be interesting knowing that he is somehow related to the Jubilees that and Ben Jubilees. Well, these are things we accept now. I mean, but years ago, it was almost impossible not only to be a resident But that isn't Pittsburgh. I think that's that's nationally in the United States.
Yes.
And that is a problem of the Jewish organizations who have handled this thing, I think, pretty well. And now we do not feel surprised that in Pittsburgh some of the presidents of some of the big corporations are Jewish.
What did you go so far as to say that you don't see any vestiges of any kind of thing for them?
Well, compared to years ago, I think it is much less for some of the things that I've told you about. But I can't tell you these things because I haven't tried to observe those things. I belong to all the organizations, the Anti-Defamation League and the ADA and so forth and so on. But I'm not active in those things. And I know that there is now a new wave of subtle anti-Semitism. But I don't feel it myself. And it's very interesting that my son, who will probably defy you if you say to him there is certain anti-Semitism, his contacts are almost in business and in his law firm 99% non-Jewish, and he feels that he's accepted. And apparently it's true, the fact that he was able to, in fact, he was asked to join the Duquesne Club, whereas he was also asked to join the Concordia Club and refused.
I was assuming not because he didn't.
No, he refused merely because he thought that it was not necessary for him to belong to a lot of clubs.
Right, so
yes.
You currently impressed me with the hours you spent talking as a fulfilled man, achieved his goal. Do you have any feelings or things that you would have liked to have done?
Well, recently I read a very good article that I was visiting my children in Palm Springs, and I was sitting near the swimming pool of the racquet club. And I was reading an article that I picked up where it said, if you're depressed or you're unhappy, mark down all the things on a sheet of paper of all the, I don't know whether I said this last time or not, all the things that you think you've accomplished and that you have done rather well and that you've succeeded with, mark all the disappointments that you have had. Then look at both of those, and then you will find often that you have no reason to be depressed, that actually we're very, very fortunate, and that you ought to be happy. Well, that particular day I was a little depressed because I was there and Martha was at home because of her mother's illness. Then I realized that, well, I think my putt column was very, very good. And I would say, generally, I have to look around and find what have I done wrong. I was very fortunate in marrying a unusual wife, and also that I have two unusual children. I think they are unusual. I don't know whether I expressed this in the last episode that we had here, but I have a daughter who's a PhD in comparative literature, even though she is married and is not using her PhD for teaching purposes. Feels that she owes a certain amount to her children, and therefore she's a creative housewife. I have a very nice son-in-law who is a physician, who is a urologist. I have a son who he was the top student in his class, valedictorian at Shadyside. He was a Phi Beta Kappa and a summa cum laude at Yale, and graduated very, very well at Harvard Law School, and has been involved with a prestigious law firm, and has been looked upon as a very good asset to the law firm. And it's successful, married a very lovely girl, even though she is from White Oak. He's married to Elizabeth Africa.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, the point is, as I look back, I feel, well, there are very few things I'd want to change. Medically, there'd be one thing perhaps I'd want to change. For many, many years, I was an obstetrician and gynecologist. Then I got the idea that I liked the infertility part of it. But I feel as though I should have done nothing but infertility many, many years before I started. Some doctors in Chicago, some doctors in New York, some doctors in Los Angeles had given up their practice and confined all their work to infertility. In the medical profession, these are well-known names. Now, Dr. Tyler, for example, died not too long ago. He had the Tyler infertility trick. I know him very, very well. We were friends. He gave up his practice and started to confine his attention to infertility only. And as a result, the Tyler Clinic, notwithstanding his death, still exists with 100 doctors doing nothing but infertility in his group. And I wish I had started that earlier. Because, by the way, I'm sorry to interrupt, but the value of that is you can do a lot of research, things of that sort that you cannot do when you are doing the follow-up.
That's what I'm thinking. I'm hearing you saying that had you given, done it earlier, you may have even achieved more in that field and maybe even had some sort of additional prominence.
I don't care about the prominence part. But
you could have achieved.
But I could have achieved a lot more. For example, if you have a good clinic with a group of men who you have shown the things that one should do in a infertility program, you have time to study research work on those things. Many times I was asked by drug companies, would I research certain things for them, which they would pay me for, but I had not the time. So therefore, I didn't follow along with that.
That's the one regret that you should have given earlier.
I wish I had earlier years
and more time.
And I would have spent more time. And I remember saying to my associate that infertility is a great subject, not only because the value that you do and the great respect that you have from patients who have become pregnant. When I spoke to my associates about that and told them that it's economically very good, I mean, you can earn a very, very decent income by doing infertility. But the response to my group was, yes, but infertility has a lot to do with the economic situation. For example, right now, said my associate, the economic situation in the United States is good, therefore a lot of people are trying to get pregnant. But should there be a depression or should there be a recession, then the interest in infertility would wane because, after all, it is expensive. Well, this last recession has proven that they were wrong.
Are they wrong?
Oh, they're wrong, because infertility, now, even in the recession, people will spend more money for infertility work than workouts than they did years ago. And by the way, very few of the things we do in infertility paid by insurance with companies, by Blue Shield or Blue Cross. The reason being that Blue Shield Blue Cross, for their own purposes, don't want you to become pregnant. Because they have to pay for the obstetric.
Dr. Feinberg, enjoy talking with you.
Okay.
And thank you, sir.
Well, I hope it's been some value. I'm sorry.